Welcome to the Custom Apparel Startups Podcast, your best source for information, news, tips, and tricks to get you off the ground running and earn success with your custom apparel decorating business. So get ready to soak up some knowledge. Now, here are your hosts, Mark and Mark.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 43 of the Custom Apparel Startups Podcast. My name is Mark Stevenson from Coldesi.
And I'm Mark Vila from Coleman & Company.
Oh, that's good.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes, and welcome to our next episode, episode 43.
Yeah, and today we have a special guest.
Do we? Where?
Right there. Am I pointing in the right direction? I'm looking at a video camera. This is Tom Rumbaugh. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good, yourself?
Very good. Thank you very much. Yep. And we've got Tom here for a couple of reasons. We rarely can talk any of our customers that have actually run a business into filling out a questionnaire, doing a success story, coming on a video for us would be completely out of the question. But we have you trapped here now, don't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so Tom joined us. He's now a Coldesi salesperson.
That's right.
Okay.
Business owner. Uh-huh. Business owner, former business owner in multiple different directions.
Yeah.
Sold equipment in the past, presently. Mm-hmm. How many years have you been in the industry?
It was since 1992. So what is that? That's 23, 24 years, something
wow.
like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so since 1992.
Yeah, and it's really, I don't have that much experience in the industry.
Yeah.
It's really awesome when you talk to folks who are still going in the path of this industry because there is success to be had here, and
absolutely.
It's fun. It's a fun industry to work in, so I'm really glad to have this another perspective in the room.
Sure, absolutely.
So what we're going to do is we're going to do kind of a live success story. We want to learn about you and your business before you came to Coldesi. So why don't you kind of lay out what you did, lay out your company.
I had gotten into the industry years ago, like I said, in 1992. Mm-hmm. At the time, was working not far from here selling siding, believe it or not. So
okay.
We would go around knocking on doors.
Tin man. Yeah, that's great.
And so we would try to convince people to purchase siding, and it was kind of a sleazy industry, actually. I think at one point I even traded in a gun in order for somebody to get some siding.
Okay.
We traded a Corvette and just anything and everything we could do to convince people to purchase siding for their houses, whether they needed it or not.
Right.
Kind of. Mm-hmm. And it just was not agreeing with my soul at all. It was really just, I couldn't stand it. So I answered an ad in the paper for a trainer. And one of the Coleman companies at the time, back in 1992, needed a trainer, somebody that would fly all over the country and would go and teach people how to use their embroidery machines. And
okay.
So that's what I did. I got hired on with the company. The owner's wife interviewed me at first, and I just totally flubbed the interview. and I could tell it. I could tell from noticing that she was not impressed at all. And so that night I went home and got some really nice paper, and I wrote out a nice letter that, hey, I feel like I blew it in the interview, but I wanted to say that I had just the right experience for this job. And later on she said that it was the letter. It was the letter and the
that's great.
That I knew this is what I wanted to do.
You talked your way into the business, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that job was that you got taught how to train.
Yeah.
So you got taught the embroidery machines first,
uh-huh.
and then how to train people.
Yeah, and then I would fly all over the country, and at the time we did installs for people, and I was training people how to use the software, which was at the time DOS-based, which is
terrible.
It's really tricky
it was
to
hard.
Teach.
Yeah.
I had to teach people how to use a mouse, even. And
yeah.
We had people that literally didn't know how to use a mouse. They would hold the mouse up to the screen and, they would thought that you point at the screen and that's
so,
how you
some things never change. We still have those people. No offense, everybody. No offense, but you're out there.
You're out there.
Yeah, and I think I was in 34 different states at one point, 4 different countries, teaching and training people constantly.
Okay.
And that's how I got into sales. And so became better and better at demonstrating the equipment, and they invited me to come on board and sell for the company.
Cool.
So that's how I started doing that.
And then you sold embroidery machines, et cetera. And then what made you think about going into a business?
Well, this was now about 2004, somewhere around there, 2005. And I'd worked for the company and in the industry for a long time and put hundreds of people into the business and talked them, how to get into the business. And my wife was pregnant with our first son.
Okay.
And so she just had to travel, I think, 40 miles back and forth to work every day. And I'm like, honey, why don't you, you know, if you'd like, you can just stay home. You know, we're doing okay. You know, you can start your own business if you want to.
Right.
That resonated with her. And so I wrote up a quote and sold my wife. It was the hardest sale I ever made.
That's great.
I sold my wife our first single-head embroidery machine, and that's how we started.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that story is the same story of so many of our customers.
I know. It sounds really familiar.
It's the same story that I've heard so many times in different directions, where somebody is they're a car salesman, they're a plumber, they're a teacher, they work for the school board or the board of health, whatever they do, this is not their favorite thing that they're doing. Or maybe they're commuting too far for work, or they just had some kids or something like that. They're all the same story, you know. I think the dream is that you want to have your own business. It's something that's more interesting and fun to do than maybe sitting behind a desk and crunching numbers or breaking your back on the ground.
And embroidery is kind of perfect, right? Because you get a single-head machine. Yeah. You can fit it in a back bedroom. Mm-hmm. There's no particular power requirements.
Right.
You know, all you really need is you know, maybe a computer and the machine itself. And when you started, embroidery machines were not cheap.
No, they were not. Not at all. As a matter of fact, I want to say that an entire system was somewhere around $35,000 or $40,000 for a single head. I think it was even like a six-needle single head.
Wow.
And the software was what was amazing. There was $30,000 softwares at the time.
Yeah.
Ours was not that expensive, but I think it was $15,000-$16,000 initially.
Right.
And
nobody made the software. You had maybe three people in the whole country or in the whole world actually that had software for embroidery machines at the time.
So you did it though. You got the machine and did you finance it or did you write a check?
I think we did it. Put it on a credit card.
Okay. Cool.
Part of it, and then probably paid the rest for part
of it. Gotcha.
And we did really well. As a matter of fact, in the first 6 months, she had grown tremendously. She had gotten $2,000 or $3,000 worth of orders, and she was about to have the baby, and she was kind of freaking out that month because we didn't think that we would be able to get everything done, and she was just kind of worried that we wouldn't get enough production done. And so her mom came in to help with production, and at the same time we purchased a second embroidery machine to be able to do two things at once. So the thinking being is that, okay, she's going to be dealing with the baby now, so when she embroiders, whatever time that is, she needs to be able to do it quicker.
Yeah,
than she
to maximize
before.
It.
So it wasn't the fact that we couldn't have run the machine all day long.
Yeah.
It was the fact that we've only got limited time to sew, so we need to increase our production so that time is
useful. And I want to warn everybody that's listening and watching, if you're watching the video, that we are planning on branding Tom the King of ROI. Because he's already, because he's got the experience in setting things up and, you know, costing jobs and things like that. And that's really one of the most common questions that we get. But you went to two machines, and first of all, let's just say, like what Mark was saying, you can get set up now with a single head, you know, for like $12,000.
Yeah.
Including great software and, you know.
Yeah, you can get software for, subscription software for $100 a year.
Yeah.
You know, so you can get up and running so much more affordable, and then when you need that second machine or better software or whatever it is, it's so much easier now than it was then. However, the when you're on a high dive board, no matter how high it is, the jump looks scary.
Yeah.
You know, and if
that's
it's
true.
If it's a $30,000 jump or a $20,000 or a $10,000, it still feels scary. But the people who succeed really well, I notice that they're the ones that say, I need to get another heat press.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get another embroidery machine now. Like you know, you see what's coming ahead.
Yeah.
And you make the decision, and then you dive into it. And you know, there's risk in that, but that's also like that.
That's how you do it.
That's how you do it. That's ring success.
So how long was it before you got your second machine?
It was within 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and I know it's so funny because we talk to people at Cold Essie all the time. Mm-hmm. That buy an Avance, they get a single head 15 needle, it's like, well, you know, within, you're going to need more.
Right.
You know, and within a couple of years, you can upgrade to a multi-head, mm-hmm. or you can kind of like, you know, you can hook all these up to a router, and you can get multiple single heads.
Right.
And work it that way, you know, we kind of position you to grow.
The one thing I have learned, and I have, even I think even before I started into the business and and knew this for an absolute fact, now I know it for an absolute fact, is that if you pretty much just maintain, if do nothing but maintain, and you maintain long enough, work begins to push itself to you. So like if you concentrate on doing the very best quality you can, if you concentrate on being efficient,
right,
if you concentrate on doing everything correctly, you almost can't help but grow. I mean, there's a point where the work begins to push itself, as long as you don't quit, as long as you don't take yourself out of the game before you get a chance to experience those gains. I mean, it was probably within our second year that we began to get to the point where more sales were coming in from unexpected sources than from us having to sell every job.
Yeah.
So that's when it begins to get good. You just have to basically let yourself be in the game long enough to start receiving those additional benefits.
Right.
So if you build it, it will come.
Yeah.
Type of attitude, which, you know, is what is we've talked about that attitude before, and we've also talked about not being complacent there.
Yeah.
You have to find that balance. Mm-hmm. But if you are doing good work consistently, especially with embroidery, because there's a lot of bad work.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad work.
So, but if you are focusing on doing good work and not, you know, you're not trying to save 10 cents on a piece of backing, because if you know that this other backing is going to provide better embroidery for you, you're going to have, that is going to come. It's going to gravitate towards you because you're just waiting for the one day for the, you know, for the owner of that business down the road. It was the last straw with that embroidery shop.
Yeah,
using them for a while, and then you get to talk to them.
Well, and your first business, you went out and got it.
You were
in sales.
Right.
So you use those skills.
How did you get the business? What were some specific
things? I actually continued to work while my wife ran the business. So initially it started with just her concept. So it was mostly through churches, through associations, networks that we had at church, people that we had met in business. I don't know that she did necessarily so much outbound calling.
Right.
I think it was a lot of just the people that we knew, the places that we went.
Word of mouth, right?
Word of mouth stuff. I don't recall that we really had any advertising that necessarily did a whole lot of good for us. Advertising is good if you get to a certain point in like much later on when I had left the company to work the business full time. Advertising helped to cement our name once we were at a certain point. But I think when you're just beginning, I don't know that advertising is necessarily the best way to go.
So I think
working your internal
efforts. And we talk about that all the time as well.
If I want to plug a podcast.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, there's this awesome podcast.
The CAS podcast?
CAS podcast, yeah. And there's an episode on social, not social media marketing.
Oh, yeah.
That's an oldie but a goodie, I think. I don't remember. It's somewhere in the lower numbers if you're searching for it. It's towards the beginning. But that's what we talked about is you go to church, you go to the business groups, you go to the youth sports leagues, school leagues.
Absolutely.
I mean, whatever you do, wherever you go, whatever you do, you go there and you tell people what you're doing.
Right.
And you ask. Do you ask for referrals?
Yeah.
You know, do you know somebody who needs this? Do you have it? Do you ever, you know, especially if you know small business owners,
yeah,
you got to talk to them. And in the beginning, especially, you know, there's a good attitude of maybe no job is too small. If you know this guy who's like a plumber and it's him and his son,
yeah.
And do you guys wear shirts? No.
Okay. So you're bareback.
We just wear t-shirts. You know, it's like, all right, let me make some shirts for you.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when you break it down, if somebody is dressing nice, say as a contract worker, right? They go to houses and they're wearing something nice because they want to look professional. Just a shirt like this, right?
Yeah.
If you go to Macy's or JCPenney or any of these stores and you buy just a collared shirt, it's going to cost you $20 at least.
Yeah.
And you're ready almost at the price that you can embroider it for somebody for. You can get a custom one done, you know. So you have to just tell them. You're like, it's almost going to cost the same amount of money as if you go to Macy's and buy a brand shirt.
Yeah.
I can get you one with their logo on it and do four of them for the plumber, and then, like, just please tell somebody else.
That's great.
You know?
And instead of Macy's making the profit on that shirt because there's a markup in the shirt, not just in the embroidery. You've made the markup in that shirt.
Yeah,
you've essentially short-circuited Macy's when you do that. And people are happy to let you do that. They'd much rather give an order to a small-time local business owner than they would rather have some larger mail order conglomerate
work,
and it's not even the same.
You can't lose
if you just ask and if you're nice and if you do good quality work.
It's like a good social experiment is to have on the forefront of your mind and maybe talk or ask people, say, would you rather buy your produce from like a little local shop that you know is a or would you rather buy from a big store? You know, if there was a small business that sold, you know, this one particular product, would you rather buy it from them? And almost everybody that you run into is like, I'd love to support a small business. You know, like if I can buy this, I'd much rather
buy it. Especially somebody that they know.
Yeah, people love that because it feels good. It makes the financial transaction personal and friendly. It's got almost, it has what I consider to be like a little bit of a charity feel to it. Mm-hmm. When you know this guy that you go to church with or that's on the same team, you don't know him, maybe you're not friends, but you wrote him a check for $100 for 5 shirts or whatever it was, and that feels a lot better than having gone to like Macy's and swiped your credit card.
Yeah, that's true. So you said you started getting in like these mystery orders. Mm-hmm. Right, and it wasn't like you had a big website presence or were doing advertising. How would those happen?
I'm glad you asked that because I was about to say that literally, like people know that you are in the industry, that you're in the business. Oh, you've done custom something or other. Well, I know that's what you do. Like literally, last night I went to my chiropractor, and she says, "Hey, didn't you own a shop or something at one point? You know, didn't you? You know, I'm like, yeah, I've already sold that off, and I'm back doing this." And she's like, "Wow, that's too bad, because you know, I've got these 300 shirts that I have printed with my logo on it, and I wanted to get these water bottles and this, that, and the other." And I'm like, "Well, I know just the people, you know."
Yeah.
And so I haven't decided yet who or how I'm gonna work this out, but this is an order that one of my clients is going to get the opportunity to bid on.
You know, it's great that you said that.
And it just happens that easily. All the people need to do is that you do it, and if you don't stop, enough of it will happen.
Yeah. We had somebody, we're going to be contracting with a professional video and photo guy to do some work for Poldesi, and he came into the office, and I gave him the tour. He's a local guy here in Tampa, Florida, and after he walks around, says, "Hey, by the way, I'm going to need like 24 polos with my company name on it. You know, do you guys do that too?"
Yeah.
And I'm like, "No, but let me give you the name of a customer."
Right. And it's something you remember as well. And this is, you know, a pitch for the industry, but it's, you remember when somebody does something like this, it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's not often that I talk and I'm hanging out with a group of people and what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
And then somebody hits, "I do like commercial embroidery," or "I do t-shirt printing." Immediately it's like, "Oh, that's cool."
Yeah.
So I'm like, "What?"
Everybody
like,
wants to know.
I've seen one of those at the mall. Like, you know, right. People talk about it. It's interesting and you remember it compared to like sell insurance.
Right.
You know, it's like snooze.
If you're selling insurance right now, it's okay.
No, it's
okay.
Boring. No. It's boring.
It is boring, but still.
Embroidery shops need insurance.
Yeah. That's very true.
Yeah, but this is fun, and it's something that people remember, and it happens to me still, you know.
Yeah.
I go to the doctor, and he's like, don't you do something with t-shirts? Because my son needs some, you know. And it's like, I still get that, because people remember that. It's interesting, and it's a fun thing to be in, so you have to talk about it. If you were at a dinner party or an event or a birthday party, you have to tell people there that that's what you do. Somehow work it into the conversation because you'll get referral business from it.
There's no doubt about it. And it grows. I mean, over the course of the next 10 years, I had left the company to basically work our business full time.
Yeah.
We had ups and downs. And we started out with a retail location, and then when the recession hit in 2008, we kind of had to back up and go back into our house for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Literally, people were picking up orders out the side of our garage, and I think I even went back to work for 6 months or so just to help end this meet. And then
it's a small business story, right?
Little by little, we kept sticking with it and kept going, just not stopping. And then it finally happened, and it all clicked. The second time that we went into a retail location, we just were very successful at it.
That's great.
And so it took 4 or 5 years, but now we were in a retail location. Things were booming. We added screen print the next year.
Okay.
We had added digital printers. I mean, at one point we had a 6-head, a 4-head, 2 single heads, 2 digital printers. I think I had the very first, one of the very first DTG printers that were ever made. It was like serial number 3.
Wow.
I think, you know?
Right.
And so, and we've printed thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of T-shirts.
Yeah.
So, just little by little, it builds up, and then, and just before everything sold, we were at a 3,800 square foot facility with a big automatic screen printer, and this all in the course of 12 years.
That's
so
awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
You know, people ask me a lot, well, how do you do that? Well, you just don't stop.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
You don't stop. You don't kill yourself. You just there's always a point where you get that fear, and you just kind of live with that fear for a little bit.
Yeah.
And you keep going anyway, and eventually that magic will happen for any business. I believe any business that,
yeah,
right,
has that attitude will succeed.
Yeah. So, and I want to do a quick Cold Essie commercial here, mm-hmm, because that's kind of why we do more than just one thing.
Right.
You know, because there aren't, I mean, they're still out there, but not a lot of new businesses are just going to do embroidery or just going to do direct-to-garment printing or rhinestones or vinyl. They're going to do all of those things, mm-hmm, or they're going to add all of those things. Like, how long did you do embroidery before you added something else?
We had the digital printer within a year and a half to 2 years.
Okay, and yeah, why did you do that?
We did that because we were selling embroidery to people. And then they would also need screen printing.
Yeah.
And we didn't do screen printing. So we would, sometimes we would bid it out with a subcontractor. Sometimes we wouldn't win. And then the next year, they're ready to get embroidery again. And we find out, well, they pretty much gave us the embroidery because they already had the $5,000 screen print order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I couldn't compete on screen printing. And so I felt like I needed to have that as a piece of my arsenal to prevent my customers from leaking away.
Yeah,
and we talk about that with so many things. We talk about it with custom patches, mm-hmm, you know, something
right,
like that. Because when you're really small, you know, and if you only have, if you're starting with a single head or just two heads, you know, you're going to get all these unique things and the ability to be very nimble and to say, okay, you need 12 patches in addition to all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. I can do that small little patch order for you. You know, I've learned how to do it. I know how to do it. It's
right,
pretty simple, and you don't have to, you prevent that leak away.
Yeah.
It's also why we encourage folks to get into, even if it's just heat transfer vinyl in the beginning, if you can't do the screen printing.
Yeah.
You know,
to be able to do T-shirts.
Yeah, to be able to do T-shirts. Screen printing, yeah, it's like you can make that shirt, and you can put pennies worth of ink on it. And the transfers in general, period, vinyl, whatever they are going to cost more.
Yeah.
It's not going to be as profitable, but for the size of the investment you make and completely preventing,
yeah,
or almost preventing all that leaking from happening from them going to another shop.
Right? It's the opportunity to say yes. It's a self-defense move,
yeah,
as much as it is a bid for more profit.
Right, yep,
right?
Exactly. And so literally about every other year we would add something new.
Yeah.
Until we got to a point where $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 is coming in every month.
Yeah.
And we felt at that point now we could start paring away some of the ones that were not the most profitable. So we initially used them to capture till our company got to a certain size.
Yeah.
And then at that point we decided to trim where we needed to trim.
So, 'cause you could afford to.
We could afford,
yeah,
to at that point. Right, exactly. So whereas we did a lot of signs and a lot of banners and things in the beginning, like for the first, you know, 2 to 3 years, we kind of backed out that business once we had an automatic screen print press that could do 1,000 shirts a day.
Yeah.
You know, so printing up 20-yard signs just wasn't as much
on
our radar
as
it did in the beginning to get that, you know,
yeah,
$500 shirt order. You do 20-yard signs to get $500 shirt order. Made sense. So it kind of reverses itself. So,
yeah, and it goes along with that same example. And in the beginning, you might add the patch option as something you'll say yes to.
Right.
You know, I'll do these little patch orders. I'll do, you know, from 1 to 50, you know, whatever the number is you decide to do. And maybe that's really good for you. And we have customers that they take off with that.
Yeah.
That becomes a staple of their business.
Yeah.
And other folks just, they might stop choosing to do that. Same story.
Right.
You know, you have to find, like, what you're making money, what your customers want. But in the beginning, you've got to be able to go out there and just get a taste of everything so you can find your niches and what your customers
want. It's why so many Avance 1501Cs, the single-head embroidery machines, go out with a cut-and-press system from Coleman & Company.
Mm-hmm.
It's so somebody can say yes to, okay, You know, you don't want to embroider 14-inch letters on the back of somebody's jersey, right. You know, or football numbers or things like that. You don't want to do that. And there are some logos, if you've got a one-color logo that it takes you 3 seconds to heat press on, mm-hmm. you know, it's a lot faster than embroidering 5,000 stitches.
Our favorite time of the year was baseball season because literally teams would come in by the dozens, you know, a dozen of this, a dozen of those, a dozen of this. Every team would come into our shop and they would order, and in that case they would pay cash. So there were whole weekends where they had to get all of their team jerseys named and numbered up, mm-hmm. and we would walk out with $3,000 or $4,000 cash by the end of the weekend, having served 20 or 30 teams at a time.
Yeah. Wow.
And so cut and press is just a great tackle, yeah, during those right seasons.
Yeah, yeah. And a great way to enter into it. You know, in the beginning when, because as you're growing your business or you're in a point where you have a decent-sized business and you're trying to step up into another game to be able to do the same, going back to what we said before, to be able to go to, you know, your cousin's kid's game, could you go, you know, every couple games to watch and just be able to, you meet the parents and you meet coaches.
Yeah.
And it's like you get one team, you know, to convert
yeah.
over, or you just get parent T-shirts. You
yeah.
know, maybe you're just doing custom parent T-shirts in the beginning, but like, and you're building up because you're asking for that business. And the parent T-shirts, if you're doing a better job than the people who are doing the kids T-shirts, they're noticing the parent fan shirts look nicer than the kids uniform
yeah.
shirts, and you might
and
end up
in.
With the work.
And you're in.
You know, I mean, it's all like little stories like that, but this is stuff that we consistently hear from our customers like every day.
Yeah.
You know, these are the little things that they're like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what I'm going to do now. Like, I thought I was, you know, I was so worried about making money,
yeah.
and all of a sudden now, like,
I got into a softball league, and now they want to order regionally,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
all the jerseys for the softball league that no one else was paying attention to.
There were times when it was an all-night affair with multiple people,
mm-hmm.
friends and
yeah.
family coming in to help out just to get the workout. I mean, jerseys spread out all across the shop.
Yeah,
just, yeah, it's it gets that way.
Yeah,
it's good stuff though.
Yeah,
right?
Another thing that I think about this industry is so cool. From a nice little warm and fuzzy, corny feeling,
yeah.
it is something. When you do a business like this, it is something that it can bring friends and family together, which
yeah.
is a very warm thing because little kids can come in and like. Weed vinyl or pick up trash on the ground or
yeah.
full put T-shirts in boxes.
I just want to say here that Coldesi does not support the violation of any child labor laws in any state in North America.
We do.
But yeah, that's what I would do.
Like you get, you know, if you have kids, like, you know, that you want to get, that want to hang out with you, they want to do anything that you want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about that the other day
yeah.
I'm doing some home renovations on and off lately, and anything that I want to do, if I tell my 5-year-old daughter I'm doing it,
mm-hmm.
she wants to do it with
wants
me.
To do it
yeah.
with
you know, and
too,
so
yeah.
it's like if you do this business and you do have young kids, it's like the kids can put shirts in boxes. They love it.
To be part of it.
To be part of it.
Helpful,
and
yeah.
and it's so cool because there's a lot of industries. Repairing computers is not something you want your 5-year-old kid anywhere near.
I can tell you that's true from experience. Yeah.
But with apparel, you know, it's fun. So I think it is cool. And you know, it can be an adventure with that.
Yeah.
So it's a good warm and fuzzy thing and of encouragement, I think.
I agree. My kids, grew up with embroidery machines, hearing them all day long. And my son, one of the first things he helped out with was hooping shirts. We
awesome.
You know, showed him how to hoop shirts, and he had fun doing that. And so, yeah.
Yeah,
so neat.
Cool.
Enjoyed it.
It is fun to
so he did
do and watch.
Quit, you know, and he went on and did it.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
Went to play video games.
Yeah.
So tell me about the transition from having those two heads and getting your first big multi-head machines. Like,
uh-huh.
what motivated you to make that decision?
Okay. What happened there was we got to the point where we had put together a proposal for the SBA, Small Business Administration. Went down, talked with one of their representatives locally. We had family that was willing to help invest. And so ultimately it was a mix of other funding along with family funding, along with money that I had saved up.
Right.
And we decided, okay, this is it. And so I put in my resignation with the Coleman Company. We had a nice guild send-off,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
as they're just great people to work for, love working for them.
Yeah.
And And away we went. So we, you know, that's how we launched, and we immediately bought the six head, knowing that we were going to target larger work because we had more overhead. So we figured we're going to need more production.
So that's good.
And that's when we bought the digital printer, was with those loans.
So I have a question about that. What do you say to folks that maybe they've hit the end of their investment cap and they would like to ask friends or family for that? How did you feel comfortable doing that, or what approach did you take, or what advice might you give?
That was done just automatically. Okay, that was my wife's family, so they basically saw what she was doing, wanted to help out, and it was available.
So, gotcha. Yeah. So they were ready.
They were ready. I don't know that it's anything I would tell people to necessarily go pursue.
Because
you know, there's good and bad to that. You know, we had some pretty rough years there that made things tough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if it can be done without family money, that's probably a better way to go, quite honestly. I'm just going to be straight up about that.
Sure. Yeah. So it's, I guess it's situational.
So you were like ready to go, and you saw that there was enough business out there.
Yeah.
And thought that with your help, it could get to another level. So you kind of got the multi-head equipment and the digital printer.
Right.
As the next step in your business, as that regular growth kind of path.
And then I went out and did what I've been telling other people to do, which is get out and sell.
Right.
You can enjoy the art of embroidery and the art of decorating apparel all day long, but what gets you to be able to continue to do your art is the ability to bring in some money from it. You know, so you do have to be promoting. You do have to be out there. And keep getting your name out there day after day after day, and it's that longevity that will ultimately make your work multiply. I mean, I think after the third or fourth year, we got to a point where we didn't really need to go sell every job. That almost we did nothing more than just answer the phones, and that's what happens. I mean, that's when it really gets juicy, is when you're just answering phones because the work is pushing you. People are hearing about your work, telling other people. That alone is enough just to keep you busy.
You developed the reputation and had the referrals coming in.
Yeah.
We hardly ever say the S word on the podcast, the word sell, because it scares people to death.
Sure.
We did a podcast called Active Word of Mouth, which is basically you going out and selling, you know, what you do.
Well, I'll give you an interesting success story. When the very first month that we started, very easily my wife and I embroidered up some nice shirts. And we had developed this real easy approach, because we had a shop now, we had a location, we had the six-head machine, we needed to keep busy, and my wife wasn't so much into selling, and obviously I've done, you know, siding sales, so I was at least comfortable with walking around. So we just grabbed some shirts, and we just walked around the businesses, and if it said no soliciting, we didn't bother them. If they didn't say no soliciting, we walked in and said, hey, you know, we just opened up a shop just not even a few blocks down the road. If you guys ever need anything, shirts or promotional items, let us know. We'd be happy to put a bid in for you. Yeah. And that's it. That's all we would say. That little comfortable conversation, no hard pressure. I'm not trying to convince them to buy. And we literally, I think we saw 12 or 15 people that day. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the week, we had 3 orders from 12 people.
Yeah. That's what we talked about.
And I swear to you, that is exactly how it goes.
So
if you're willing to go talk to 12 or 15 people near where you're at that have businesses that could potentially buy shirts and walk in the door with shirts and just simply say, if you ever need any of this, please give us a call. Here's our card. We'd love to help you. Done.
Yeah. I mean, literally, we did a set of 3 on how to make more money next month. Mm-hmm. And that was exactly exactly.
Yeah. That one day we ended up with $4,000 worth of orders. And of course, in our case, we were pricing God. We were like, wow, we can't.
Yeah.
You know, this is really going to work. And,
I'm
not so sure that we did it too many more months after that. I don't know that at some point it became just not like
you had enough.
We didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And it's like if you don't need much, you know. Business card or a simple flyer or a postcard, whatever you want to make, you know, that's simple, a little bit of information, like wearing what you know, we talk about wearing what you do. Or bringing some out. And if you don't want to sell, you don't have to go in and ask for an order, because what you were doing wasn't a heavy sell. You're just, and you can look, just go down the shop, and if it makes sense that they order, You know, I wouldn't go into the McDonald's. You know, that might not be the way to do it.
Right.
You know, but if it's a CPA office, you know, you could just walk in. Hey, by the way, just pop it in real quick. We do custom shirts. We're right down the road.
Yeah.
If you need help, here's our info. We appreciate you guys.
Here's my card. Here's my work.
Here's my card. You know,
if you're involved in any teams or organizations, you know, we'd love to put a bid. That's it.
Yeah, and we're a local. Right. And say we're, you know, use the local business. We're a local small business, and you know, we're looking to do things for our community.
Yeah.
And you just, like we said, there's going to be, we talked about in the podcast that there's going to be ones that right then and there, let me get Tom.
Yeah.
And lady is running to the back, you know, because, like, Tom was just talking about this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and other times you might get phone calls, and it literally can happen in as little as 12, you know, but it's like if you're doing 12 a day for 12 days, I mean, I would be blown away if you got none.
Yeah, no.
I mean, that would be anomalous. Like,
it's quite easy, and there's a point where we had 9 sales reps that were working for us.
No
so
kidding.
I used to train, you know, sometimes I would see somebody that had a terrific attitude, and I felt they'd be great at this.
Yeah.
And I would have to kind of coach them past that fear. But literally, it's invariably they would start up with us, and I would just say, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go hit just 15 businesses today. That's it. You call it a day if you want. Go do something else. Hit 15 businesses a day. And invariably within the first month, they were $4,000 or $5,000 worth of sales, even more, and just often away we go.
Times 5 or 6 salespeople.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So just having that little bit of impetus. And then at some point, again, for them, it would be they didn't really have to go out and do that too much.
Yeah.
They're getting the referrals.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
And business networking groups are terrific for that because they're just, you know, if you meet once a week with a business networking group, they're just automatically going to send you anything they hear.
Yeah, and if you don't know those, you know, you can find them like online in little local newspapers and things like that.
We were involved in a BNI group, which is a business networking international group.
Right.
It's the biggest and best probably. There's other ones that are just more like leads groups.
Yeah.
Yep.
But when you meet with people week after week after week, it's like having 20 other sales reps that are concentrating on trying to get you business. Why, you know, givers gain. So you're concentrating on their business. They're concentrating on yours. People that I know that can help them, it's just automatic. You're gonna send them their way.
Yeah, and there are less embroiderers in the world than there are insurance salespeople. There's less of them than realtors. And
it's going to be like, oh my God, I don't have to talk to another copier guy. That's great.
You can go to a business networking group, and or go to 5 if you want each month, you know, and as many as you want to of them, and they will call you months later because they haven't had another embroidery person in their group for months. So I still occasionally get calls from my, you know,
that's great.
That are in my network groups.
And I have, so we talk to some people where they say, well, I don't have kids, don't have a big family, I'm not involved in anything, you know, like, so you give all these examples and I'm a part of none of them. And my thought is, well, then now you have a complete new different level of freedom because you can go on to like meetup.com. And all these BNIs, and if you have a day job, or if you're taking this over full time, you have plenty of time to do it. But if you have a day job, then you can plan to. Well, I'm just going to go to meetup.com for whatever my interest is, whether it's books or religion or kayaking. Like you're going to go if it's a kayaking thing, and you're going to go. There's going to be a dozen people there. You're going to meet, and they might not be selling for you like the BNI people are, but there's 12 people you're going to meet.
Yeah.
You're going to do something you like to do, and then make sure all of them know that you're an embroiderer.
Yeah, and there's the LinkedIn, like, after-work cocktail hours, things like that are going on all the time. All those places are great.
So if you don't have the kids in dance and Little League and high school where you can get, like, then you have the opportunity to go get different ones and meet other, you know, you're single and you have the, or a young couple, you know, without a big family. So you have the opportunity to just go to all other events.
Yeah.
There are people out there to meet, you know, just get in front of, and you're not selling to any of them.
When I talk to people that are starting their business, that's some of the number one questions that I ask them is I think that that we concentrate on it differently than I think other companies do. And the fact that I'm interested in, well, where do you get your work from? What kind of work is it? There's a whole other aspect of rather than just selling someone a machine, there's this whole other aspect that I'm concentrating on, because I don't want to just sell them a machine and then feel like they're floundering for months. I want them to know how they're going to attack the market, what their plan is. And in some cases, people are just saying, well, I want to do my art with the machine.
Right.
And in that case, then that's, as long as they just make their payment, they get to create their art, that's what they
that's
want.
That's great, yeah.
No worries about that. No foul.
We talked about, what were we saying it the other day about it, as far as like financing your own hobby.
Yeah.
You know, which is perfectly acceptable to do that.
But there are other people that want to make a business of it. And if they want to make a business of it, and if they're willing to just do a couple small, potentially uncomfortable things, you know, for their nature, it can really pay off big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It really can. And you can build something that is not only good for yourself, but for your kids, for your family. You just have to keep pushing. Mm-hmm. What is that? Hitting the rock?
Pounding the rock.
So I do want to ask one question that we ask kind of like everybody in our success stories and things like that. What was your biggest hurdle when you started up? You know, what was your biggest...
Biggest hurdle when I started up? I would say along the same lines, the biggest hurdle starting up for us was working together as a couple.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it was interpersonal, and it really does take a long time to get good at working with somebody that you're so close to.
Yeah.
You know, and we used to butt heads a lot. At one point, we kind of separated duties, like, okay, you concentrate on embroidery, I'll concentrate on promotional products.
Right.
When recession happened, we had to just kind of join forces and just come back together again. That forced us to really kind of work with each other, I guess you could say.
Yep.
And I'm more big picture person. She's kind of details. And so we began to liken it. Like she's like the magnifier looking at a picture, and I see the big picture. So when she would allow me to move her to different spots, you know, she'd say, I don't see an elephant, Tom. There's no elephant here.
Right.
I see a bunch of gray streaks, and it looks wrinkly. You know?
Yeah.
And so she can't see what I'm seeing, and I can't see what she's saying. Well, no, there's an elephant here. It's not a bunch of gray streaks. It's an elephant. Mm-hmm. And so when she allowed me to position her in certain places and say, okay, check this out. And when I listened to those details, accepted those details as true, even though I couldn't always see them, we became a really good mix.
That's very familiar. My wife and I have had a couple of businesses like that, too.
Yeah, you've got to...
Strengths. Work with your strengths.
Yeah, work with
and
them.
And accept the flaws of each other.
Yes. So
that's just part of it. You have to accept 100%.
Yeah, and it's like in interpersonal, which I studied. I know something about it.
Did you really?
Communications. Yeah, that's what I studied. But one of the things, an exercise, like a great exercise to do in any, because it's not just couples. You could be starting with a friend.
Yeah.
You could be starting it with almost an associate. You know, that you someone you kind of know who you end up, you know, getting together. I mean, you don't know who it is. But whatever it is, a great exercise to do is to write down things you're good at, and then on the other side of the paper, be honest with yourself and name like a few things you're not good at.
Just
you know, and just say like, the getting down to the nitty gritty details I'm not good at, or I just don't like.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's easier to ask yourself what you don't like, because you also don't like the things you're not good at.
Yeah, normally.
So, you know, often. So you can write those things down, and then you take that list together. You know, and you compare it, and then you can immediately just say, okay, these are all of these duties I put on the things I'm good at and I kind of like, and they're on your don't like. So immediately you can, like, you can create that environment.
Right.
Writing things down, I think, is huge for everything that we said.
It's like the E-Myth, the book E-Myth, you know, talks about all of that kind of, you know, this is everything I'm good at, this is everything I'm not, this is how to work with a partner, you know, no matter where they are.
And write down a little mini sales plan to say, like, what am I going to do? You know, just actually write it down, you know, and just say, or put it in a notes, you know, notes on your phone. What am I going to do? I'm going to go to 12 businesses. I'm going to say what I do. I'm going to hand them a business card, and I'm going to say, if you ever need anything in the future, I'm a local small business. I'd love to earn it.
Yeah.
And you write down, that's my little mini sales plan.
Right.
It fits on one screen on my phone in the notes tab.
Right.
That's it. Yeah. And then you can do it. And then you can have another one that's just about know, business strengths and weaknesses, about when is there going to be a point where you decide to have the conversation about investing in that second machine or the bigger machine.
Yeah, sure.
You know, write all these little things down.
People think that a partnership, and especially if you're working with your spouse, is 50-50. And that is not the case. It's 100% you accept that person. End of story. That's the total end of your responsibility. You can't control whether they are also going to accept you 100%. But if you do get two people that are accepting each other 100%, then you really have a good partnership.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
we definitely had that at times. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
So awesome. Is that, or do you have another kind of final piece of advice that you would give somebody that's just looking at, hey, I want to start a custom T-shirt business or embroidery business?
I do. Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you. I mention this a lot when I talk to people selling wise, but I'm glad you brought it up. One of the things that people don't do, I think sometimes too well, is they don't track where their sales are coming from. What I mean by that is, even recently I saw somebody that had a whole listing of sales, and I think they've got a pretty good business. It's $300,000-$400,000 a year that they're selling, but they don't have it in channels. They don't know how much of that is screen printing, how much is promotional items, So I would say that along with every invoice, you want to use QuickBooks ability or whichever accounting software that you have. Use their ability to track the type of sale that it is.
Okay.
And I think that's ultimately critical, because how do you make the right machine decisions? How do you determine what is the best purchases?
That's good.
It's just a really helpful thing to truly understand, not just guess about your market. We kind of talked about this even before the podcast, is that I can have wonderful thought. I could be the most insightful person that I think I am.
Right.
But it doesn't mean I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may get the facts and figures and find out that, I thought this was, I had a couple of stink bombs in there, things that I thought were going to be wonderful for the market and for us and for our business, and come to find out they just failed miserably.
Yeah.
And that
know your numbers thing is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go by what you feel is your most successful part two, or how much work you put into things. Keep tracking as much as you can without stumbling over the tracking is great. Right. Because how many hours are the machines running? How much time are you standing in front of them? Where is the business coming from?
We run into that here at Cold SE too, I will actually ask the salespeople, how's leasing going? Or, we're having a lot of people get turned down, this month as opposed to prior month. And I'm really, you go back and check the numbers and that's just not true.
Right.
It's actually the same number or more are getting approved, but it's your ability. So you may remember a customer that bought a bunch of screen-printed T-shirts from you,
right?
But you won't remember the one that was three times as profitable that bought embroidery from you.
Along the same lines, I will remember something else I told every sales rep that I trained.
Yeah,
is that you have got to forget that one thing, that one customer that drives you nuts. There'll always be one deal, one situation where you didn't make the sale.
Right.
That you felt like you were taken advantage of or whatever it is.
Right.
And I've had sales reps that would talk about that client to everybody that they could remember for the next 2 or 3 months. So you just have to let go of those hurts.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can't let those hurts define you, because the quicker you get rid of the hurts, the quicker you stop talking about the one customer that bought from somebody else.
Yeah,
the easier it is for you to accept that there's plenty more good out there, And
it's so true. You are going to, if you go out to the shops and or to go out to companies and hand out your business card.
Yeah,
at some point in time, this probably will happen. You're going to walk in, you're going to say, hey, I just want to let you know, no soliciting, like somebody will be this weird, obnoxious, like almost not human reaction. But however, that can stop somebody. It gets sucked into your brain.
Yeah.
And we have the voted stickers on.
Yeah.
And you could say the same thing about, like, within politics, where somebody could say XYZ supporters, like, they're so jerks, or they're so ignorant. And I'll say, well, who? When? And they're like, well, my cousin said, oh, who else?
Okay. No, that's it. That's
so, so most of the people you know are reasonable. They just disagree with you on things. Yeah. You know, and it's like, but that one person makes it, defines a group. And when they're selling, you know, that one bad sales situation could feel like, well, oh my gosh, customers are so rude.
And that's why knowing your numbers is, you know, like the good news is that I was in outside sales for 20 years, and I had one person be rude to me the entire time.
Yeah.
So it just, you know.
And you remember it?
I do. I remember it. I can tell you a small university in southern Georgia. I can remember that guy vividly.
Right. And I have found that sales reps will end up talking and talking and talking about everybody they meet. They bring up that one person. Mm-hmm. And it is a psychological chain that holds them back from the success. And so that's my
great
piece of advice is let that go, that rope, you know, I mean, an elephant, for instance, you know, an elephant is tied to a rope that is very small, in a small stake in the ground. I mean, if an elephant wanted to, he could pull that stake up.
Yeah.
He could break the rope if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But what keeps him there? What keeps him chained to that little stake is that they've got that little psychological, it's a little elephant when they were little, when they were just learning, when they first went out, they first tried something new. They got, you know, they ran into that rope that they couldn't break at that time. But now as they have grown, they don't realize they can break that rope. And we do that with ourselves, with our bad customers that we constantly remember, that we drive ourselves nuts. We won't even go out into certain areas that could be wildly successful for us because we have a psychological chain from that bad memory, from that one client who screwed us over or whatever they did.
Yeah, so how
that's
about
really insightful,
how about reinforcing those good ones instead? Like those first 15 businesses that you went to see, and at the end of the week, there was $4,000 worth of sales.
Yeah, exactly. And if you have that one bad experience and you're replaying it in your head, a good thing you could do is to right after that, you know, you can just force yourself to do it. Say, let me think of like a really nice person.
Oh, right. Like, yeah, remember person that just walked in and with a bag full of cash?
Yeah, and or you just think of like, well, you know what, like, yeah, that guy's a jerk, but like this other guy is like, he's so great. And in fact, like, we also became friends, and I've read like 3 books that he's recommended now.
Yeah.
You know, so you get that.
I'm going to go sell him something right now.
Yeah, and my I was just having that conversation about that psychological thing with my dog. I wasn't having a conversation with my dog. I was having a conversation about my dog. I have a gait.
I think I'm having a bad experience.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's it.
I have a gait that I would lean up against things when the dog was a really, really little puppy. And just like, I don't want you to come in this room.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd leave because you're getting the bathroom trash. So I just lean the gait up there, and she just couldn't get around it or over it.
Yeah.
Well, now that she's 80 pounds,
right,
I still can lean that up against where the cat eats her food.
Right.
And the dog could just literally bump into it and knock it over if she wanted to. But she sees it's there and doesn't attempt to get the cat food at all.
Yeah, right.
And it's literally like she could put her nose around it.
Right.
But
that's cool.
You know, and it's like we build those walls. I mean, that was just funny. I was just saying that. I was like, this, since she's a puppy, she thought she couldn't get through. She's 80 pounds. She still thinks
that's
she can't get through.
That's right. So,
and these are all hard lessons I've learned through business, through being in business and having a lot of hard stuff happen.
Right. But on the other side, you know, you went from part-time your wife and one embroidery machine that you spent a freaking lot of money on, to two, to having your own business, to buying multiple machines, to having 6 or 8 salespeople working for you, to managing all of them, and you did that just like with your own two hands.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like you give birth to these things, you know, without just by making that first decision. Says, you know what, like I can do this, and I'm going to do this. And as long as you keep track of your customers, don't let things, like you said, don't stop. Then there's success out there for you know, for just about everybody.
Don't stop, and you know, in our case, we were building our retirement, so that's what our end goal was.
Nice,
and we helped make a big piece of it. So yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Absolutely. Great.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop.
Yeah. Okay. I hope, just like I hope with every podcast.
Yeah.
I hope that people listen to this and they get encouraged that you know, like, don't give up. You can do it.
Yeah.
It's not always easy. You know, it's not always a straight arrow up in your business, you know, but like, if you're passionate about it and you want it, just keep going. And you'll find the right directions to go if you're focused on it and you keep trying and you keep pounding it. You'll get the right directions.
And at one point it will begin to push itself to you.
Yeah.
It will be just trying to keep up because it builds its own life. You put so much work into something and then it begins to build to where it nurtures you as much as the other way around.
And that's when you call Tom Rumbaugh from Cold Messy to get that next machine. To get that next machine. That's
ready,
the way it works.
I'm ready to keep up.
All right.
That's important. So great.
Well, in that case, this has been Mark Stevenson from Cold Essie.
And Mark Viola from Coleman & Company.
And Tom Rumbaugh, also from Cold Essie.
That's right.
You guys have a good business.
Thanks.